The following presentation is a production of 63 Audio and the Narada Radio Company, a proud member of the Mutual Audio Network.
Do you dare go down into the cellar? Welcome to the Cellar, Miniseries 4. Starring the Narada Radio Company. And hosted by Kadavra Quivery.
I'm so sorry to keep you waiting. I was temporarily hung up at the end of a rope. I swear, I'll probably be late to my own funeral. Oh, well, come to think of it, I was, wasn't I? Oh, I'm so very glad to see you again, creeps. I thought perhaps our last episode might have been a little too frightening. Oh, but I see you're back for more. So, speaking of ropes, our story for tonight deals with one of my favorite uses for them. Let's go over to my great big book and find it now. Tonight, creeps, we go back in time to 19th century England. A certain Mr. Benson is entertaining a clergyman one evening when they start talking about... Oh, but that would be giving the story away. I'd say sit back, dearies, but I think it'll be more convenient to just start off on the edge of your seat for this one.
I recently had a local clergyman, Father Dennis Hanbury, to my home for dinner, and as we sat by the fire to enjoy brandy and cigars, the subject of religion versus spiritualism arose, as it usually does in such situations. I began telling him about an extraordinary seance which I'd attended a few nights before.
Do you mean to say, Mr. Benson, that this, spiritual medium, as you called her, was able to reveal information that was known only to you and your late friend?
Yes, Father. A whole series of things. The medium said that my friend was present in the room and was speaking through her.
How very interesting.
Yes. Now, naturally, from the strictly scientific point of view, which in my opinion is the best way to approach such phenomena, this information imparted by the medium wasn't really evidence that the spirit of my friend was in touch with her.
No? Why do you think so?
Well, simply put, because the information was known to me. You see?
I don't quite...
Well, because this information was in my mind, and these things might have been transferred telepathically to the medium from my brain, and not through the agency of the dead. She spoke, too, but not in her own ordinary voice, but in a voice which certainly was very much like his.
Ah, but wouldn't this then indicate...
Not necessarily. Because, of course, my friend's voice was known to me as well. The sound of it was in my mind right along with all of the things the medium was saying. Therefore...
Yes?
All this, therefore, Father, cannot be taken as positive evidence that communications had been coming from the other side of death.
I see.
A telepathic explanation was possible, and we have to accept any known explanation which covers the facts before we conclude that the dead have come back into touch with the material world. Father Dennis shivered slightly, despite the warmth of the room, and hitched his chair a little closer to the fire. After a moment or two spent in holding his hands out to the blaze, he shook his head and said,
"It's a terribly dangerous thing to attempt communication with the dead. If you seem to get in touch with them, you run the risk of establishing connection not with them, but with awful and perilous intelligences."
I had anticipated such a response from Hanbury. I knew about his beliefs and deplored them. He holds, as his church commands him, that communication with the spirits of the dead is impossible, and that when it appears to occur, as it undoubtedly does, the seeker is really in touch with some species of dramatic demon who is impersonating the spirit of the dead. Such a thing has always seemed to me as monstrous as it is without foundation. For I have studied the recognized sources of Christian doctrine, and there's nothing I have been able to discover which justifies such a view.
So study telepathy by all means. Yes, that is one of the marvels of the mind which we are meant to investigate, like any other of the wonderful secrets of nature. But I interrupt you. You said something else occurred. Tell me about it.
Yes. Now comes the odd part. For, still speaking in the voice of my friend, the medium told me something which, instantly, I believed to be untrue. It could not, therefore, have been drawn telepathically from me. After that seance came to an end, and in order to convince myself that this couldn't have come from him, I looked in his diary, which had been left to me in his will, and which had just been sent to me by his solicitors, and which was still packed away. There, I found an entry which proved that what the medium had said was absolutely correct. I won't go into the details, but a certain thing had occurred precisely as the medium had stated, though I should have been willing to swear to the contrary. This event could not have come into her mind from mine, and there is no other source that I can see from which she could have obtained this information except from my friend. What do you say to that?
I don't alter my position at all. That information, given it did not come from your mind, which certainly seems to be impossible, came from some discarnate agency. But it didn't come from the spirit of your friend. It came from some evil and awful intelligence.
But isn't that pure assumption? It is surely much simpler to say that the dead can, under certain circumstances, communicate with us. Why drag in the devil?
It's not very late. Unless you want to send me home, give me your attention for half an hour and I'll try to show you.
Fine with me. I'll go get us some more brandy.
Though you're not a Catholic, I think you would agree with me about the institution of confession. In particular, the sacredness and inviolability of it. If there was the slightest chance of the penitent's confession being made known to anyone, unless he himself, for purposes of expiation or of righting some wrong, chooses to repeat it, no one would ever come to confession at all. The church would lose the greatest hold it has over the souls of men, and the souls of men would lose that inestimable comfort of knowing that their sins are forgiven. Furthermore, I think you would agree that the priest cannot repeat what has been told him. By doing so, he might right or revert some hideous wrong, but it is impossible for him to do so. What he has heard under the seal of confession concerning the sacredness of which no argument is conceivable.
It is possible to imagine awful consequences resulting from it. But I agree.
Before now, awful consequences have come of it, but they don't touch the principle. And now, I'm going to tell you of a certain confession that was once made to me.
But how can you? Surely, after what you've just said, I mean, that's impossible, isn't it?
For a certain reason, which we shall come to later, you will see that secrecy is no longer incumbent upon me. But this is not the point of my story. No. It is to warn you about attempting to establish communication with the dead. Signs and tokens, voices and apparitions appear to come to us from them. But who sends them? You will see what I mean.
I am all ears, as the saying goes.
You'll probably not remember very well, if at all, the murder of a man called Gerald Selden about a year ago. There was no enticing mystery about it, and it aroused no public interest. Selden was a man of loose life, but he held a respectable position, so it would have been disastrous for his private irregularities to come to life. For some time before his death, he was receiving blackmail letters regarding his relations with a certain married woman, and he reported these to the police. They pursued certain clues, and on the afternoon before Selden's death, he received official word that everything pointed to his manservant, Alfred Wadham, being the culprit. A young man, Wadham had only recently been employed by Selden, and his past history was of the most unsavoury sort. On the morning after Selden's receiving this word from CID, the cleaning woman came in and found the outer door to his flat open, and Selden himself lying dead on the floor of his sitting room with his throat cut.
Good Lord!
Wadham had disappeared, but in the slop pail of his bedroom was water which had been stained with human blood. He was caught 2 days later, and at his trial, Wadham elected to give evidence. His story was that he suspected he had fallen into a trap, and that while Mr. Selden was at dinner, he searched his bureau drawers and found the letter sent by the police, which proved that this was the case. Wadham therefore decided to bolt, and he left the flat that evening before his master came back from dinner. Being in the witness box, he was, of course, subjected to a searching cross-examination, and contradicted himself in several particulars. Then there was that incriminating evidence in his room, and the motive for the crime was clear enough. The jury, after a very long deliberation, found him guilty, and he was sentenced to death. He appealed the sentence, but this was dismissed.
Yes, I do recall reading something about Wadham's case, but as you said, it really was quite commonplace.
Wadham was a Catholic, and since it's my office to minister to Catholic prisoners, I had many talks with him and entreated him for the sake of his immortal soul to confess his guilt. But he maintained his innocence on the charge of murder. Nothing shook him. And though, as far as I could judge, he was sincerely penitent for his other misdeeds, he swore to me that the story he told in court was, in spite of the contradictions, essentially true, and that if he was hanged, he died unjustly. Up until the last afternoon of his life, when I sat with him for 2 hours, praying and pleading with him, he stuck to that. Why should he do that, Mr. Benson, unless indeed he was innocent? That he was eager to search his heart for the confession of his other sins was curious. The more I pondered, the more inexplicable it became to me, and during that afternoon, doubt as to his guilt began to grow in me. I was to be at the prison again before 6 in the morning, and I still had to determine whether I should give him the sacrament. If he went to his death guilty of murder but refusing to confess, I had no right to give it to him. But if he was innocent, my withholding of it was as terrible as any miscarriage of justice. So, on my way out, I had a word with one of the prison guards, which brought my doubt closer to me. I asked him a question, but before he answered, he drew aside to let a man pass by. The man nodded at him, and somehow I knew he was the hangman.
What did you ask the guard?
Just this. What do you make of Wadham? I asked.
What do you make of Wadham?
I don't like to think of it, sir. I know he was found guilty and that his appeal failed, but if you ask me whether I believe him to be a murderer, why, no, I don't.
That evening, at about 10 o'clock, as I was on the point of going to bed, a servant told me that a man called Horace Kenyon wanted to see me. He was a Catholic, and we had been friends at one time.
What happened between you, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, certain things had come to my knowledge that frankly made it impossible for me to remain friends with him, and at that time I told him so. He was wicked. And while all men are now and again guilty of some form of wickedness, Kenyon was a man who seemed to love wickedness for its own sake. I said I could not see him, but he said his need was urgent. And up he came.
I want to make my confession, Father Dennis.
Kenyon, it's late. Can't you come back tomorrow?
I can't make it tomorrow. I must make it tonight. My priest is unavailable, out of town. Please hear me.
Very well. As a priest, I cannot refuse you.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I killed Gerald Selden.
What the devil?
For a moment, I thought this was some impious joke, but he swore he was telling the truth. And still, under the seal of the confessional, he gave me a detailed account.
I dined with Selden that night. Afterwards, he invited me up to his flat to play cards. On the way up, Selden grinned and told me that he was going to have his servant arrested for blackmail. A smart, spry young man today, he said, but a bit off colour by tomorrow at this time. Selden rang for his man to lay out the card table, but saw that it was ready, and soon forgot that his summons had gone unanswered. We played for high stakes, and each of us drank a great deal. Selden lost hand after hand, and eventually accused me of cheating. I didn't like that, I can tell you. And hot words soon led to blows. I can't remember how it happened, but in our struggle I found a knife in my hand, and I stabbed him in the throat, severing both jugular and carotid artery. In a few moments, Selden had bled to death.
How horrible! What did you...
But then I remembered the unanswered bell, and I tiptoed to the servants' room. I found it empty, and all the other rooms were empty as well. If anyone had been there, I was prepared to say that I had been invited up. But when I arrived, Selden was already dead. But this was better yet. I had only a few spots of blood on me, so I washed them off and emptied the water into Wadham's slop pail in his room. I left immediately after that, leaving the door to his flat open.
Kenyon told me this just as I have told it to you. Then he looked up at me with a smiling face and said,
"So what's to be done next, venerable father?"
"Oh, thank God you've confessed. We're in time yet to save an innocent man. You must give yourself up to the police at once."
"Eh? What a quaint notion. Indeed, there's nothing further from my thoughts."
"Well, I should go myself then."
"Oh, no. Indeed you won't. What about the seal of confession? I rather fancy it's a deadly sin for a priest to even think of violating it. Really, I'm ashamed of you, Dennis. Naughty fellow. But perhaps it was only a joke. You didn't mean it."
"I do mean it. You shall see if I mean it. Anything is allowable to save an innocent man from death."
Pardon me. You know perfectly well that it isn't. There's only one thing in our creed far worse than death, and that is the damnation of the soul. You've got no intention of damning yours, and I took no risk at all when I confessed to you."
"But it will be murder if you don't save this man."
"Oh, certainly. But I've got a murder on my conscience already. One gets used to it very quickly. And having got used to it, another murder doesn't seem to matter one bit. Poor young Wadham. Tomorrow, isn't it? Ah, well. I'm not sure it won't be a sort of rough justice. Blackmail is a disgusting offense. Really, this is most interesting. Calling the police, are we? Walton Street is the nearest station. You don't need the number. Just tell the operator Walton Street Police. But you can't, can you? You can't say, I have a man here with me now, Horace Kenyon, who has confessed to me that he murdered Selden. So why try to bluff? Besides, if you did try it, I would deny saying so, and it would be your word, the word of a priest who has broken his most sacred vow against mine. Don't be childish.
Kenyon, for the love of God, and for the fear of hell, give yourself up. What does it matter whether you or I live a few years less, if at the end we pass into the vast infinite with our sins confessed and forgiven? Day and night I will pray for you.
Charming of you. But I have no doubt now that you will give Wadham full absolution. So what does it matter if he goes into the vast infinite at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning?
Why did you confess to me then, if you had no intention of saving him and making atonement?
Well, not long ago you were very nasty to me. You told me no decent man would consort with me. So it struck me, quite suddenly, only today, really, that it would be pleasant to see you in the most awful hole. I dare say I've got sadistic tastes, too, and they are being wonderfully indulged. Oh, my. Just look at the torment on your face, my dear Hanbury. I know you would choose any physical agony rather than to be in such a torture chamber of the soul. It's entrancing. I adore it. Thank you very much, Dennis. You know, I've kept my taxi waiting this whole time. I have no doubt you'll be busy tonight. Can I give you a lift anywhere? His Majesty's prison? Pentonville, perhaps?
There are no words to describe certain darknesses that come to the soul. And I can only tell you that I can imagine no hell of remorse that could equal the hell that I was in. Here was a torture blank and meaningless. And then my brain stirred a little, and I began to wonder whether, without breaking the seal of confession, I might not be able to effect something. It seemed possible that without violation I might tell the Home Secretary that a confession had been made me, whereby I knew that Wadham was innocent. He would ask me for any details I could give him, and I could tell him... Then I saw I could tell him nothing. I could not say that the murderer had gone up with Selden to his room, for through that information it might be found that Kenyon had dined with him. Before I did anything, I must have guidance. So I went to the home of the Cardinal, by our cathedral. I told him, without giving any clue, what had happened. And his verdict was what in my heart I knew it would be. Certainly I might see the Home Secretary and tell him that such confession had been made me. But no word or hint must escape me which could lead to identification.
Personally, Father Hanbury, I don't see how the execution could be postponed on such information as you could give. And whatever you suffer, my son, be sure that you are suffering not from having done wrong, but from having done right. Placed as you are, your temptation to save an innocent man comes from the devil, and whatever you may be called upon to endure for not yielding to it is of that origin also.
I saw the Home Secretary in his room at Westminster within the hour, but unless I told him more, and he realized that I could not, he was powerless to move.
He was found guilty at trial, and his appeal was dismissed. Without further evidence, I can do nothing. Good God, it's ghastly. I entirely believe, I needn't tell you, that you've heard this confession, but that doesn't prove it's true. Can't you see the man again? Can't you put the fear of God into him? If you can do anything at all, which could give me justification for acting, up till the moment the drop falls, I will give a reprieve at once. Here's my telephone number. Ring me up here, or at my house at any hour.
I was back at the prison before 6 the next morning. I told Wadham that I believed in his innocence, and I gave him absolution for all else. He received the Holy and Blessed Sacrament with me, and went without flinching to his death. I have been coming a long time to the point of my story, Benson, which concerns that séance you spoke of. But it was necessary for your understanding of what I am going to tell you now that you should know all this. I said that these messages and communication from the dead come not from them, but from some evil power impersonating them. You answered, I remember, why
drag in the devil?
Yes, yes, so I will tell you. When it was over, when the drop on which Wadham stood yawned open, and the rope creaked and jumped, I went home. It was a dark winter's morning, still barely light, and in spite of the tragic scene I just witnessed, I felt serene and peaceful. I didn't think of Kenyon at all, only of the boy, for he was little more, who had suffered unjustly, and that seemed a pitiful mistake. But no more. It didn't touch his essential living soul, and I was humbly thankful that I had been enabled to act rightly. And had Kenyon now, through my agency, been in the hands of the police and Wadham alive, I should have been branded with the most terrible crime a person can commit. I had been up all night, and after I'd set my office, I lay down on my sofa to get a little sleep. And I dreamed that I was in the cell with Wadham, and that he knew I had proof of his innocence. It was within a few minutes of the hour of his death, and I heard along the stone-flagged corridor outside the steps of those who were coming for him. He heard them too, and stood up, pointing at me.
You're letting an innocent man die when you could save him. You can't do it, Father Dennis.
I woke, knowing that what had roused me was my own name, screamed out from somewhere close at hand. And I knew whose voice it was. There I was, alone in my quiet, empty room, with the dim day peering in. I had been asleep, I saw, for only a few minutes. But now all thought or power of sleep had fled, for somewhere by me, invisible but awfully present, was the spirit of the man whom I had allowed to perish. And he called out to me. But presently I convinced myself that this voice coming to me in sleep was no more than a dream, natural enough in the circumstances. And some days passed tranquilly enough. And then, one day, when I was walking down a sunny, crowded street, I felt some definite and dreadful change in what I may call the psychic atmosphere which surrounds us all. And my soul grew black with fear and with evil imaginings. And there was Wadham, coming towards me along the pavement, gay and debonair. He looked at me, and his face became a mask of hate.
We shall meet often, I hope, Father Dennis.
Another day, I returned home in the twilight, and suddenly as I entered my room I heard the creak and strain of a rope, and his body, with head covered by the death cap, swung in the window against the sunset. and sometimes when I was at my books, the door opened quietly and closed again. And I knew he was there. The apparition or the token of it did not come often, or perhaps my resistance would have been quickened, for I knew it was devilish in origin. But it came when I was off my guard at long intervals, so that I thought I had vanquished it. And then sometimes I felt my faith to reel. But always it was preceded by this sense of evil power bearing down on me, and I made haste to seek the shelter of the House of Defence, which is set very high. And this last Sunday only... I had been preaching for one of our missions. The church was full. It was a morning service, and the sun poured in through the stained glass windows in a glow of coloured light. But in the middle of my sermon, some bank of cloud drove up, and with it this horrible forewarning of the approach of a tempest of evil. So dark it got that as I was drawing near the end of my sermon, the lights in the church were switched on, and it leapt into brightness. There was a lamp on the desk in the pulpit where I had placed my notes, and now, when it was kindled, it shone full on the pew just below. And there, with his head turned upward towards me, with his face purple and eyes protruding, and with the strangling noose round his neck, sat Wadham. My voice faltered a second, and I clutched at the pulpit rail as he stared at me, and I at him. A horror of the spirit, black as the eternal night of the lost, closed around me. For I had let him go innocent to his death, and my punishment was just. And then, like a star, shining out through some merciful rent in this soul storm, came again that ray of conviction that as a priest I could not have done otherwise. And with it the sure knowledge that this apparition could not be of God, but of the devil, to be resisted and defied. It could not therefore be the spirit of the man at which I gazed, but some diabolical counterfeit. And I looked back from him to my notes, and went on with my sermon, for that alone was my business. That pause had seemed to me eternal. It had the quality of timelessness, but I learned afterwards that it had been barely perceptible. And from my own heart, I learned that it was no punishment that I was undergoing, but the strengthening of a faith that had faltered.
Suddenly he broke off. There came into his eyes, as he fixed them on the door, a look not of fear at all, but of savage, relentless antagonism.
It's coming. And now, if you hear or see anything, despise it, for it is evil.
Through the door, something entered, nothing visible, but I knew that there was now in the room a living intelligence other than Father Dennis's and mine, and it affected my being, myself, just as some horrible odor of putrefaction affects one physically. My soul sickened it. Then, still seeing nothing, I perceived that the room, warm and comfortable just now, was growing cold, and that some strange eclipse was veiling the light. Close to me on the table stood an electric lamp. The shade of it fluttered in the icy draught that stirred in the air, and the illuminant wire was no longer incandescent, but red and dull, like the embers in the grate. I scrutinized the dimness, but as yet, no material form manifested itself. Father Dennis was sitting very upright in his chair, his eyes fixed and focused on something invisible to me. His lips were moving and muttering. His hands grasped the crucifix he was wearing. And then I saw what I knew he was seeing, too. A face was outlining itself on the air in front of him. A face swollen and purple, with tongue lolling from the mouth. As it hung there, it oscillated to and fro. Clearer and clearer, it grew, suspended there by the rope that now became visible to me. And though the apparition was of a man hanged by the neck, it was not dead, but active and alive. And the spirit that awfully animated it was no human one, but something diabolical. Suddenly, Father Dennis rose to his feet, and his face was within an inch or two of that suspended horror. He raised his hands, which held the sacred emblem.
Begone to your torment. Begone until it is over, and the mercy of God grants you eternal death in the name of God.
Just as suddenly as the apparition had appeared, it was gone, and warmth and light were restored to the room. Father Dennis's face was haggard and dripping with the struggle he had been through, but there shone on it such radiance as I have never seen on human countenance.
It's over. I saw it shrivel and wither before the power of God's presence. And your eyes tell me you saw it too. And you now know that what wore the semblance of humanity was pure evil. But I've already taken up enough of your time. Thank you, Benson, for your indulgence. I forgot. You wanted to know how I could reveal to you what was told me in confession.
Yes. Can you tell me now?
Yes. Horace Kenyon died this morning by his own hand. He left with his lawyer a packet to be opened upon his death, with instructions that it should be published in the daily press. I saw it in an evening paper, and it was a detailed account of how he'd killed Gerald Selden. He wished it to have all possible publicity.
But why?
He gloried in his wickedness, I think. He loved it, as I told you, for its own sake, and he wanted everyone to know of it as soon as he was safely away. Well, good night, Benson.
Welcome back, fiends. Well, I don't know about you, but that story gave me an absolute chill. Brr. I guess I'll have to throw another leg on the fire. Our episode was called The Hanging of Alfred Wadham, an audio play by Pete Lutz, adapted from a short story by E.F. Benson, originally published in 1928. And I, as you know, am your very own, dear departed, Cadavera Quivery. So, until next time, fiends, remember, don't take candy from stranglers.
The Cellar is produced and directed by Pete Lutz. The theme was composed and performed by Tom Rory Parsons. Our cast consisted of the following players: Les Marsden as Benson, Kareem C. Cronfley as Hanbury, Dana Gonsalves as Kenyon, and Pete Lutz as the guard, Wadham, the cardinal, and the home secretary. Cadavera Quivery is played by Angela Young. Additional music was by Dr. Ross Bernhardt. This is Trevor Rhines speaking. The Cellar is a 63 audio production mixed and mastered in Corpus Christi, Texas. Join us next time when Cadavera takes you to a foreign legion outpost in the Sahara for a weird story of dead soldiers brought back to life by an insane scientist. It's called Death Holds the Post, and that's next time in The Cellar.
Yeah, 63 audio.
This